Okay, I'm pleased to introduce Dave Bomer, longtime telecommunications executive, who's presented several times at Sabre and also at the Cooperstown Symposium. He's going to be talking about a 1961 perspective of Frick's 61 asterisk ruling. Thank you, Bob. Great to be here. I guess this is the last two presentations going on. I'm officially the cleanup hitter or the finisher or something of that sort.
Closer, right?
That's a better term. Thank you. How many of you, when you hear the name Fort Frick, immediately think of the asterisk? I thought I would see a few hands in that regard. To me, Frick, in many ways, I'll go through the historiography of that, but in many ways, I would call him the Rodney Dangerfield of commissioners. He really doesn't get a lot of respect. But let's go through very quickly the historiography behind this, because there is a very rich literature that perpetuates the asterisk in many ways. Let's start with the book that came out a couple years after the infamous asterisk, Beck is in Wreck, which is one of the better read baseball books of all time, and is a very humorous and hilarious book in which he continuously lambasts Fort Frick, calling him it's a league matter, calling him a few other things, and saying that it was the asterisk was the worst public relations event that was ever done. I asked Mike Beck in an interview some years ago why his dad hated Frick so much, and he said, "Oh hell, my dad hated anybody who wore a tie." Roger Kahn wrote a piece sometime, I think, in the 70s or early 80s that was very critical, more sympathetic of Maris than it was critical of Frick, but just saying that that was a blemish that had hurt Roger Maris in the process. As a result of reading that, and I interviewed Faye Vincent about 3 years ago, he literally said it was the Kahn article that caused him to, in effect, change what was considered Frick's ruling and, in effect, get rid of the separate record and treat the 61 home runs as the single home run record at the time. And, of course, it's, as we know, been broken since, although under continuous controversy because of the whole steroid issue. It didn't end with Faye Vincent's decision. Billy Crystal came out with the movie 61 asterisk, and in the process of coming out with the movie, also portrayed Fort Frick as somebody who was fixated, I mean literally fixated, on trying to hope in watching every single game, which I'm not sure how he did, to see Maris fail to break the record. Interestingly, Frick, along with Babe Ruth's widow, was at the last game when Maris, in fact, did indeed hit the 61st home run. And then there was Larry Mothey's book, a good book, an evaluation of the commissioners, although he considered the 18 years of Frick and Eckert as the wasteland era of baseball, the era in which decisions that were made that didn't really respect the traditions and interests of the game. And one of the things he most criticized Fort Frick about, of course, was the infamous asterisk. And I'll finish with the biography of Fort Frick that came out last year, which, of course, you can buy over in the bookshop. And you notice the title. And, of course, the first chapter in the book is focused on the asterisk. Now, one side point here, there was no asterisk. There never was an asterisk. The asterisk was Dick Young's invention. When Frick made the statement, Young wrote in a column and said, "That sounds like putting an asterisk by the record." What Frick said, abbreviated, was in effect, if after 154 games the record is broken, then there will be a distinctive mark put by it. He never said asterisk or anything else. He simply said, he did say the term distinctive mark, and out of that came the term asterisk. Now, you can see that that's been viewed badly for a long time, been looked at negatively by most folks. The asterisk is what's most associated with Frick's name. But let's go back to 1961. at the time this happened. And of course, that was fixed, quote, done in July 17th of 1961, in the first season of expansion, and of course, only the American League had expanded that year. Sporting News took a poll of the sports writers. And in that poll, the sports writers, by a 2-to-1 margin, favored the decision, thought it was the right decision, that adding 8 games to the season, in effect, gave more opportunity for a hitter to break Ruth's record, and that therefore it was fair and appropriate that it would be treated as a separate record. But it wasn't just the sports writers who were interviewed. Sporting News also did a poll of a random sample of ball players, and in fact, by almost the same exact margin, the ball players favored and thought that the ruling of the commissioner, at least the statements that he made, were the appropriate direction by which to evaluate the season. So in effect, the reactions were pretty good. And in fact, there's a couple of interesting quotes. Probably the most important is by this guy. Mickey Mantle, in effect, said, "If I should break it in the 155th game, I would not want the record." So Mantle, in effect, who was one of the two, obviously, who was going after the record, and in July 17th, I don't know the exact number, but they were both at about 35 home runs, so they were both in contention for the record at that time. Mantle essentially said, "I had to break it in 154, or it doesn't mean anything." Even their prestigious teammate, Whitey Ford, in effect said, "It's got to be done in 154 games, or it won't mean anything." That was generally the consensus of a lot of the players. Maris was also interviewed and quoted. Maris's quote was more convoluted. He didn't say that that wasn't the right decision. He didn't say that he agreed. He didn't say that he agreed with the decision. He didn't say that he argued the decision. It just sort of didn't really say a whole lot. I guess you could read in between the lines that Maris, in effect, didn't really agree with the decision but wasn't going to make a strong public statement about it. And from what I know about Roger Maris, that would have been keeping with him, that he would not have been somebody that would have been strongly vocal about something he disagreed with so strongly. The biggest reservation at the time, and this came more from the sports writers than the players, but it was a reasonable reservation, was, why wasn't the ruling made before the start of the season? Why did it take so long for them to come up and try to make this ruling? And I think that's a valid criticism. And this is where doing this in the contemporary context really matters most. Because if you look at it from the perspective of the Commissioner of Baseball, this was not a particularly easy time, given what happened. So let's go back into 1960 and look a little bit at the sequence. First off, go back to July of 1960. This is Estes Kefauver. I think that's a great portrayal of him on Time Magazine. Kefauver, of course, was the chairman of the Anti-Monopoly Committee in the Senate, and he was the key at this point in chairing a hearing associated with changing the baseball reserve clause, which was critical to the Continental League's ability to sign players. Branch Rickey, of course, was the commissioner of the league. The driving force behind it was New York attorney William Shea. And in effect, what they were trying to do was get access to players, because baseball's reserve clause essentially reserved every single player that was signed to a contract. So the whole attempt of this antitrust legislation was to basically get this through the Senate, through the Seidler Committee. They thought they could get it through the House without any difficulty. They lost in the Senate, went down to defeat. And in effect, at that point in time, the two leaders of the Continental League, Mr. Rickey and William Shea, essentially conceded. They surrendered. Rickey, I don't think, having been in baseball as long as he was and having even been through the Federal League battle, was one that wanted to try to set up an outlaw league. There had been threats with the Continental League that it would do that, but I don't think that that was particularly what Rickey wanted to do. And with this, they conceded, but they conceded on condition that, number one, baseball in fact expand. And I think the commissioner was quite happy that that was happening, because I think he had been trying to convince the owners for some time that they needed to expand, but not enough of the owners were in support until this came out. First, that they had to expand, and the second condition was that they had to expand into four of the Continental League markets, most specifically New York, which was what Shea was most interested in all along, but they had to expand into four of the Continental League markets. The National League meets in mid-October, and in effect, that is exactly what they do. They move into New York, which had been declared an open market by the commissioner, and they also select Houston as their other choice. Houston was, of course, a huge boom town at this point, a very logical choice for a baseball club, and had been one of the investors in the Continental League. So all's taken care of. The American League meets 2 weeks later, and the driving force in this league happened to be the two owners of the Yankees. First off, Del Webb, who was on the left-hand side, pushed very hard for the American League to get out west. Ever since he owned the Yankees, he wanted the American League to go out west. He wanted the St. Louis Browns to go west. He wanted the Philadelphia Athletics to go west. Neither did. Of course, the Athletics eventually did, but neither did at the time. But Webb and Topping basically pushed the American League meeting to make a couple of decisions that didn't go along with the consensus they had before. At this point, just to add a little side point before I get to the next slide, the Clark Griffith had been, or Cal Griffith had been chomping at the bit to move to Minneapolis for a couple of years, and the owners had blocked him because they didn't want to vacate Washington, D.C. So Minneapolis had been one of the Continental League cities, and as a consequence, the American League was meeting in one of its two commitments by going there. They immediately put a team back in Washington as well because there was with all the hearings that had been going on in Washington, the last thing that baseball wanted to do was vacate the city at that time with all the antitrust issues that they were undergoing. So, essentially, they make the decision, or I'll go back on that for a second. Essentially, they make the decision to go to their other decision is to go to Los Angeles. They decide that to fulfill Del Webb's wishes, to fulfill the American League's wishes, and L.A. had also been declared an open city, a city that could support two teams, so they decided that this was the time that they would take advantage of that, and then also had the franchise in Washington. The problem that they had was Mr. O'Malley. And for good reason. O'Malley, of course, had moved there starting in the 1958 season. He had had to go through all kinds of hoops in order to get out to Los Angeles. The excellent presentation, and I see Andy McHugh out in the audience, basically explained the problems initially that that O'Malley had in going there. He had to pay, I believe, $1 million for the rights to buy out two minor league teams from the Pacific Coast League, both the Hollywood and the Los Angeles Club. He bought Wrigley Field from the Cubs in order to get the territorial rights of the minor league team out there. And he, after a number of negotiations, agreed to build a ballpark and then set up a separate agreement to play in the Coliseum. So all of these things had been major costs in moving the club out there. It proved very successful. As that presentation also showed, they drew huge crowds very quickly. And that and the Giants move put the National League way ahead of the American League in terms of their ability to attract fans. O'Malley was not going to go along with this. And while both of these markets, LA and New York, had been declared open, there were still issues of territorial rights, and particularly in O'Malley's case because of the large costs he had incurred in moving out there. The original plans when the Angels team was announced, and Hank Greenberg was a major force behind it initially, the original plan was that the essentially the Angels would go out there, they would play in the Coliseum, they would split time with the Dodgers, and the original thought was that they weren't going to have to pay the kind of they weren't going to have to compensate O'Malley. O'Malley had other thoughts about that, and for about the next month and a half, there were major negotiations in which the commissioner was directly involved with O'Malley, and what was finally decided in effect was, if the Angels were going to go out there, first off, the baseball owners had to vote and had to approve the fact that the These markets were open. There had never been an official vote of the owners in baseball that both of these markets would be open markets. They voted, they had to approve that, but in order to approve it, O'Malley got the compensation for half of his investment in moving out there and the agreement that the Angels would play in Wrigley Field, not the Coliseum, for their first year, and then once the Chavez Ravine was built, they would play there until they got their own ballpark. So O'Malley got what he hoped for in this process. Del Webb got what he wanted because the Mets to move into New York had to pay the Yankees $100,000 in order to for that to become an open market. So in effect, all of this was a process that he had to go through, and this was done by mid-December, and then you had to focus for the next 2.5 months on creating essentially two new ball clubs, which had not been done in baseball in effect since the Federal League had been created, or before that when the American League was created. So essentially the important points to understand as the 1961 season started when Frick was making this ruling were as follows. First, the 10-team leagues were going to be temporary. They weren't going to last. Second, the expansion to 12 teams was imminent. In 1958, Frick said that within 10 years, we will have 12 teams in each league. They will be split into divisions. There will be playoffs that establish who wins the pennant as well. That prediction in 58 was 1 year off. In effect, it didn't happen until 69. And in fact, in 61, they thought it was going to come about even sooner. And finally, the thing that was thought about at the time was with expansion, we would go back to 154 games. The 162-game season would not continue. Of course, we all know that didn't happen. In effect, they stayed at 162. But at the time, it was the mindset was, you know, this is just an anomaly. This is not going to last. This is not going to happen for stay for a very long period of time. So, essentially, with that understanding, it sort of made sense for the decision that Frick made. The biggest question that was asked at the time that made even more sense was that by Dan Daniels, a very close colleague of Ford Frick's in New York when Frick had been a sports writer and was considered one of the dean of sports writers in New York City, and that was, who keeps the records? Because in effect, it wasn't the commissioner who made the records. It was the sports writers who basically controlled and oversaw the records of baseball. So in effect, one could argue that by making this, quote, ruling, Frick was stepping over his bounds. What I would contend in the case of Mr. Frick was that in fact what he did was not make a ruling whatsoever. What he was doing was holding a press conference and making a statement of his opinion without necessarily saying it's my opinion. Now, I have no record to show this, but in terms of somebody knowing the rules, Ford Frick at this point in time had been in baseball as either president of the National League or as commissioner for 27 years. Ford Frick was a stickler for enforcing the rules. If something didn't follow the rules, he pointed it out to the owners and made sure they changed it in order to get the rules followed. So in effect, I would have to say that Ford Frick probably understood the sports writer's oversight of this and control over this as much as anybody would have, and probably wasn't purposely stepping on their grounds, but at the same time, I think what he was doing in making that statement was knowing that as commissioner, I'm going to make a statement and it will probably be accepted, and in fact it was. In doing so, I would say that in the end, a ruling that he really didn't make became a rule that lasted for the next 34 years until such a time as Faye Vincent took it away. But in terms of the contemporary context and conclusion, what I would say is, one, if you look at the time frame, the decision does not seem like it was out of line in any fashion, particularly understanding the perspective of where they thought baseball was heading at that point. And number two, it's not even quite clear that it was a formal ruling on the commissioner. Now, finished to add one last thing, there's no question that Ford Frick wanted to see Ruth's record preserved. I don't think there's any doubt about that. As somebody who was Babe Ruth's ghostwriter, as somebody who socialized with, he and his wife socialized with Babe Ruth and Claire, as somebody who golfed with Babe Ruth, as somebody who was one of the last to see Ruth on his deathbed, I have no doubt that Frick wanted to preserve the record. But in saying that, I would also add that I'm not sure that his intention was to make it as a formal ruling, but rather to see that, but I don't think he was dissatisfied with seeing it interpreted that way. But in the context, it was not something that was certainly unpopular in 1961 when he made the decision. And with that, I'll open it up to questions. Yes, sir.
Yes, I find it interesting, your statement, in your presentation, the statement that the 162 games schedule was meant, apparently meant to be temporary, and how to wait for that with the with Commissioner Frick's statement about Ruth record.
Mm-hmm.
I had not known this, and apparently, presumably, Mr. Frick did not explain this at the time, apparently, from what you said, what I understand, none of the sports writers who criticized the decision discussed this factor, and I wondered about that. And I also wondered, when was the decision made, if the attention was the time of the expansion that the 162 game schedule would be temporary, when was the decision made that it would not be temporary, that it would be continued permanently?
I don't know the answer to that last part of the question. Obviously, the expansion took place in 1969. That happened, as I understand it, a little more haphazardly than had been intended when it took place. But I think if I were to conjecture, I would have to assume that the owners understood that playing eight more games meant that much more revenue, and therefore they didn't necessarily want to go back, and besides which they added eight more games but didn't do any change to player salaries. So in both of those regards, it was a pretty sweet deal for them, and one that they didn't necessarily want to go back on. Yes, sir.
Earlier in the day, there was talk about Branch Rickey and some discussion of the rich treasure trove of his papers. Are you aware of any Fort Frick papers depository, and if so, any chance to look into that? Might have given you a little more insight into his what he was just expressing a public opinion or his own private opinion, or whether he was acting officially as commissioner.
Frick was not a very good correspondent. In fact, there are no Frick papers. I have checked the Hall of Fame. I've checked with Major League Baseball. The biographer actually contacted me and asked if there were any papers at DePauw University, where I worked at the time, and there are none. Frick, in his memoir himself, said, I found that I could accomplish a whole lot more by a phone call or a one-on-one in-person meeting than I could otherwise. So the best records you have of Frick are either what you find in the New York Times or the Sporting News, or what you find in the minutes, mostly of the National League minutes when he was president, because his time as commissionership, other than 1952, is closed off by Major League Baseball for access. There's a 65-year time frame on being able to look at the minutes. And for that matter, as has been well put, most of the time the decisions were decided by the time they got to the joint meeting that involved the commissioner. It's a rare case that you would have found a situation argued by that time. So, to my knowledge, you'll find scattered letters. Frick wrote a memoir that's not the best written book for somebody who I would consider a very intelligent man. But that's where he at least explains what his management style was and sort of explains why you don't find the kind of records that you might like to look for there. I haven't looked at the Rickey papers. That's on my intention to look at, but how much is there, I'm not sure of. I've talked to Lee about that, and of course he was looking at other things when he was going through it. Yes, sir.
Obviously, this record revolves around Ruth's home run record as far as the controversy, but was there any interest among the sports writers as it applied to other seasonal records like doubles, triples, stolen bases, hits, that sort of thing?
I think the assumption at the time, and of course you had, I think it was with Maury Willis the next year, you had the case of where he in fact had broken Ty Cobb's record because Cobb had had two extra games during the season that the tie games that he had played in. But the ruling was held consistent at the time that Ty Cobb's record stood because Willis didn't break it in the 154 games. So that's the only other record I remember that was affected. But the implication, I guess, and what the sports writers all assumed was since that had applied to the home runs and then applied to Murray Wills, that it was going to apply to the others as well.
Yes. Added to that, I've often been surprised that there was never any discussion or controversy when Sandy Koufax knocked off the strikeout record the single season, you know, 383 versus 382 that Christy Mathewson held, but because of the 162 game season, he got more starts. You know, and why was that not an issue? You consider Christy Mathewson, like Babe Ruth, one of the first five guys in the Hall of Fame, and an absolute titan of sport. He was the master of them all.
What year did that happen? Was it 65 that he did that? Okay. I don't have an answer for that. It did not come up in the research. I don't remember it coming up in the Sporting News, or at least that Frick was asked to make a comment on that. He did on Murray Wills' case, but I don't remember seeing that with Koufax. Of course, at the time he broke it, Frick was a lame duck. He was retiring at the end of that year, and he stayed on only because the owners delayed in finding a new commissioner, only to come up with William Eckert at the surprise and shock of almost everybody. Yes.
I got something on Del Webb, and Del Webb, while a co-owner of the Yankees at the time, he was also the one that developed all the Sun Cities, beginning with the Sun City outside of Phoenix, Arizona, that's still there. And so we had Western Expansion on the brain, apparently. I don't happen to know, was he from the West or was he a Eastern New York guy?
I don't know the answer to that. He obviously had his business enterprise was pretty much in the West. I mean, he built, and I think he may have been a Westerner. He was recruited along with Topping by Larry McPhail when McPhail had struck a deal to buy the Yankees from the Rupert family. But I've not researched Webb enough to answer that question. Andy, do you know?
I don't know where he was born or raised, but he definitely made all of his money on the West.
Right. And he was a very, I know in the Baltimore situation when they worked hard to get the St. Louis Browns that that Webb was one of those who balked initially. Of course, the first time when the American League at this point had a, it only took six of the eight owners to approve a move. The National League, it had to be unanimous. Which said a lot about what O'Malley and Stoneman pulled off because they got all eight of the National League owners to approve of their move before it was finally decided. In the case of the American League, it took six out of eight votes, and it was virtually a foregone conclusion that Vec was going to Baltimore. It was more questionable as to whether Milwaukee, the Braves were going to go to Milwaukee. In fact, much to everybody's shock, the Braves move was a unanimous vote, and the vote to keep the Browns in St. Louis, I think, was 5-3 against Vec in the move. And part of that was the fact that Vec had already done some things to tick off the rest of the American League owners, and so that was sort of their way of getting back at him. But part of it was also Webb's resistance and thinking that they really ought to and needed to get a team out west. Ed?
So thanks to Wikipedia. Webb was born in Fresno, California, and says dropped out of high school to become a carpenter's apprentice. And in fact, it says here that at age 28, he suffered typhoid fever and result moved to Phoenix, Arizona to recover.
Okay, so he was a Westerner.
He said that we consider Wikipedia to be authoritative. I'm
going to answer that question.
Well, I had no sense of him being in New York, but why the Yankee investment or how McPhail found him in Topping, I have not researched. I don't know. But I know that it was McPhail who made the decision to buy the Yankees and then recruited them because they had the money. McPhail certainly didn't. Thank you.